Okay, we begin here on the bottom of Kufay Amud Bet, three lines down in the wider lines. Chaltza Bishnaim. This is the end of the Mishnah. Amar Rav Yosef Bar Nyume, Amar Rav Nachman, Ein Halacha Keoto Zug, which we saw quoted earlier, that the Halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Asanlar. Va'avar Rav Nachman Chad Zimna. Didn't Rav Nachman already give us this Psak Halacha? The Amar Rav Yosef Bar Nyume, Amar Rav Nachman, Chalitza Bishlosha. You have to do chalitza with three. So, by definition, if you have to do chalitza with three, that disqualifies position of Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan Sanlar. So why does he need to also say that the halacha is not like them? Where it says, tzrichi, di itmar hach kamaito. If I only had the first one, which says the halacha is not like them, hava minu hani mili lechatchilo. Lechatchilo, the halacha is not like them. Hava divi avad, afilu trei. Vidi avad, even two would suffice. Kamash malon, ein halacha koto zug. That's why we say, no, the halacha is not like them at all, that you can't even use two, period. If you told me that the halacha is not like them, and we would infer from that that the halacha is like the Tanakama, then have a minute diavad. That's only b'diavad that the halacha is like the Tanakama, that you can use three. Like Rabbi Yehuda, you should need five instead of three. Tzricha, therefore I need both statements to tell me, first of all, three is absolutely l'chatchila, and number two is, Bidiyavad, you cannot use less than three. Three is the number, and that's it. Now, with regards to five, it happens to be that most told that we still use five, but not Mi'ikar Adin. That's because of what we saw earlier in the Gemara for Pirsume. The fact that we want to publicize the issue, therefore we use five. But Mi'ikar Adin, you only need three individuals of Beit Din in order to create the environment in which the Chalitza can be done. Again, this relates to a machloket besides this of the Rishonim. You can see this in the Tosafot as well. I spoke about it a little bit on the Mishnah, which is how many do Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zlatanlar say? Do they say two or do they say one? And that depends on what you think the Girsa is in the Mishnah, as well as what you think the reference to. One of them was found Karov Pasul. Is that only referencing the three? Or is that also referencing the two that they mentioned? Whether two is the Girsa in the Mishnah. From Rashi, it seems clear that it's only two, that they think that you have to have a minimum of two, whereas according to Tosafot and some of the other Rishonim, it seems to be that even one would be okay according to them. Right now, the Gemara continues with the last part of the Mishnah, Maaseh Shechaltzu, that incident that took place in the Beit HaTzurim, where they had Chalitza Beino LeBeina. So where it says, Beino LeBeina, Mi Yadano. If they did it between themselves, then who's knowing about it? Who's bringing us evidence of the fact that there is a Chalitza here? Nobody saw it. So Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmo, Ve'idim Ro'im Otom B'Mechutz. There are Edim outside that are watching, seeing what's going on. Was the incident outside of the prison? And then the question was queried of Rabbi Akiva. The halachic question was asked of him when he was in prison. Or it was the incident in the prison. And then maybe Rabbi Akiva was outside or inside the prison. It's a little bit difficult because of the nature of our Mishnah. Our Mishnah itself says that the incident took place inside the Beit HaTzurim, which makes it pretty obvious that it was inside the Beit HaTzurim. It seems to be the real question revolves around Rabbi Akiva himself. That's what the Tosavod says. V'im tomar v'hamet nitan mash behedja shechalza Beit HaTzurim. It's very clear. V'yishlamar darei sfarim garsinu b'ma se lifnei Rabbi Akiva below vav, without a vav in it. And therefore, the question here is the Beit HaTzurim modifying also Rabbi Akiva's piece of the puzzle, or is it only about the first half of that statement, which is the maaseh was Beit HaTzurim? So the real question is really about, not the maaseh itself, but about Rabbi Akiva. Where was Rabbi Akiva at the time? And then, Amar Yehuda Amar Rav, Beit HaTzurim haya maaseh, ul Beit HaTzurim ba maaseh. That both things took place in the Beit HaTzurim, which means that both the incident took place in the Beit HaTzurim, and therefore we need some sort of outside individuals looking in or seeing in that could tell us that it happened. And number two is the question that was queried of Rabbi Akiva. He was in the Beit HaTzurim. The Yerushalmi brings the story in more detail, as Tosafot says over here, that Rabbi Yochanan Sandler, one of the Talmidim Mufkakim of Rabbi Akiva, used to walk by the Beit HaTzurim, and he used to be look like a peddler, and he used to act as if he was selling items, and he would call out different things, and then he would call out a question aloch at the same time. And Rabbi Akiva would also respond, but it looked like they were having a conversation about merchandise. In the end, they were getting the luchot back and forth, and Yerushalmi describes that's how Rabbi Yochanan Sandler asked this question to Rabbi Akiva, and that's how he got the answer back from Rabbi Akiva in the Beit HaTzurim. And obviously that would make it during the period of the Hadrianic persecutions, when it was asur to teach Torah, to learn Torah, and that's why they had to do it in this convoluted manner, to get the information from Rabbi Akiva. Right now, the top of Chuv Vav Amud Aleph, Tanu Rabbanan. Chalitza mut'et shera. If you have a chalitza that is done in a underhanded way, meaning that the person is not so clear what they're doing through the chalitza, it's still effective. Ezuhi chalitza mutet. What exactly is this case here? So Amrish Lakish, kol shomrim lo chalutz ubekacha takunza. Says, you know what, do chalitza with this woman, and that will make you married to her. So basically, they say, they tell a non-truth in order to encourage him to do chalitza, and then he does the chalitza, and afterwards they go, oh, surprise, you're not married, that's it, you did chalitza, it's over. So now, Rabbi Yochanan says that, Amalei Rabbi Yochanan, anishone, didn't we just learn earlier, back on Kuf Bet, ben shenitkav einhu velo nitkav nahi, whether he had kavanah and she did not, ben shenitkav nahi velo nitkav einhu, she intended for chalitza, he did not, chalitza ta psula, that doesn't work, ad shenitkavnu shnehem keachad, they both have to have kavanah that they're doing chalitza. So how can you tell me that you're telling him that he is marrying the woman with this chalitza, and all of a sudden that's going to work? It has to be that they know what they're doing, that they're performing chalitza. V'atamart chalitza tak sheira, and you're suggesting in this incident that it would be, or in this situation, that would be a good chalitza. It doesn't make sense. Ella, kol shomrim lo chlotzla, amanat shitzen lacha matayim zuz. They say to her, listen, give the chalitza, and then she'll pay you this, basically ransom fee, this 200 zuz, which is a large amount of money, meaning that do it, and we'll give you the money. So Tanya Namihochi, we have a braita that supports that. Chalitza muted k'sheira. Chalitza that's premised on a false assumption is k'sheira. Ezohi chalitza muted. What is considered to be a chalitza that is with this false assumption? Kol shomrim chalutzla amanat shitein lecha matayim zuz. That is, he promises him to give him matayim zuz. Now obviously in the end, she's not going to pay the money. That's the trick in this. That's the underhanded manner here. Which is that we're promising money to do it. He does it, and then they don't give the money. And it works. So masa bishachat. So there was an incident with a woman. Shenafla lifnei yavam sheinu haguna. That fell to a yavam that was not appropriate for her. She didn't want to go through it. V'amru lo chalotzla amanat shitein lecha matayim zuz. She said, do the chalitza so that he'll give you the 200 zuz. Ba masa lifnei Rabbi Chiya v'chshira. Okay, the case came before Rabbi Chiya and he said, that's fine. That's a good chalitza. Obviously, even though she never paid the money that she had promised in order to get the chalitza. So here there's some sort of false premise that he's doing the chalitza, thinking that he's going to get this monetary compensation. In the end, they pull the plug on him and say he's not getting the money, and yet the chalitza goes through. All right, we'll talk about this in a little bit, why it works. Why is it that in this case it works, in other cases it doesn't work? Isn't this a condition that's built in? If you fail to keep the condition, why is the chalitza good? So we have to discuss that. So how da'atu l'kamei d'Rabbi Chiya b'arba? So another incident of Yavam. And Yavama that came before Rabbi Chiya b'Abba, Amarla, Biti, Amodi, stand up. So meaning stand up, be ready to do Yibam over here. Amarle, and here there's a question about the Girsa here. So one of the Girsa oath, we'll go with this Girsa, which is Amarle Ima. Her mother said to the judge, meaning Rabbi Chiya b'Abba, Yeshivata Zohi Amirata. Her sitting is her standing. Meaning that her sitting down is better for her than standing up over here. Which basically means that her demurring here from performing the Yibum is a better situation. She's better off with Chalitza here than she is with Yibum. So Amar La Yadatle. So Rabbi Chiya b'Abba says to the mother, you know this guy, what's the story here that you're telling me that your daughter's better off sitting down than standing up, meaning better off having Chalitza than Yibum? So he says, Amar La, in. He goes, yes, I do know him. Monahu de Chazala. He sees that she's wealthy, that she has money. And he wants to basically eat up all her money, take all of her money, and then divorce her and then throw her out. So he's only going through with the Yibum because he knows that there's this big payoff. He's going to get this big inheritance and he's going to dump the woman afterwards. So then Rabbi Chiya b'Abba turns to the Yivama herself and says, Lo Nechalach, you don't want this? You don't want to go through with this? Amarle, lo. She said, no, I'm not interested in this type of Yibum. So he said to the guy, give her a chalitza, ubekacha takunza. And through that, you'll marry her. The batu de chalatzla, after he already did chalitza, amalei, hashta, minach, ifsalala. Now for sure, you can't marry her, you can't form yibum with her, because he did chalitza. Even though, it wasn't a good chalitza, Rabbi Chiya b'Abba told him to do a chalitza in the manner that Rabbi Yochanan had rejected. Which is in the way that, if you do this, it just doesn't work, because he doesn't have kavanah for chalitza. But despite the fact, since chalitza, or a form of chalitza was performed, that disqualifies him from performing yibum in the future because it looks like chalitza. It might have been a good chalitza from the outside. The optics are, he performed chalitza, and then if he performs yibum afterwards, it would look like you could do chalitza and then yibum. We don't want that to happen. So he is disqualified from marrying her. His only choice now is to do chalitza with her. And that's what he says. Chalotzta chalitza mal yalto keechad ishtari da'alma. Go ahead now and do a real chalitza so that she is now free to marry anyone else. Now, there is a certain amount of risk in this because he could lock her in at that point. Now, it's clear that the Beit Din in this case had a lot more power, and they were going to ensure that he acted appropriately over here. The question is, why didn't he use the Eitza of Rabbi Yochanan? Right, you have the Eitza of Rabbi Yochanan, which is that you can do the chalitza with the monetary compensation and do it that way in order to come out with the outcome that he wanted. Why did he go with the suggestion of Reish Lakish, cause the chalitza to be problematic, and then do a second chalitza? Why didn't he go with the other suggestion about the condition that was based on paying money and then not paying the money in the end? There are two possibilities. One possibility is that he preferred this methodology because in this methodology, in the end, there is no quote-unquote trickery because all he does is disqualify him from performing Yibum. And then he forces him to do a real chalitza with no conditions, no trickery in it. It's a straightforward chalitza. That's number one. So that's a advantage in this format. The other advantage in this format is that he doesn't have to use kfiyah. He doesn't have to force him to do the chalitza in any way. I mean, kfiyah can be kfiyah memonit, kfiyah, some sort of pressure that is placed on him in order to do the chalitza. At this point, he does it willingly. Now, in the backup, he's got that in his hand, which is that he can force him. If he doesn't want to give the chalitza, he can force it in the end. But up front, he's allowing this to go through in a process which the potential Yavam is a willing participant. And therefore, he gets the end result that he wants without having to apply any force or any trickery in that sense, because he gets a real chalitza out of this methodology. The second thing is that Rashi brings an alternate girsa in this whole story. The way that we have it here is that, the way I read it to you was that, stand up, my daughter. And then Amrala Ima, and then her mother says, Yeshivata Zuhi Merata. She's better off having chalitza than standing up to Yibum. You know, that's a bad situation. The other possibility is that the conversation went like this, which is, Biti Amodi, stand up, my young daughter, which meant get ready for Yibum. And then Amrala Ima, then she says back to him, Yeshivata Zuhi Merata. She is unable to stand up. She either is lame in some way, she is sick, and she's unable to stand up. So then, Amarle, Yidatle, and then Rabbi Chiya Abba says, does the Yavam know this? Does he know that she's sick or that she's incapable of standing up? And then she said back to him, yes, he knows this, but he still wants to go through this because there's a big treasure chest at the end. He wants the money. So he's going through it despite the fact that it's clear that she's not an appealing wife here, but you're going through it to get to the money. So that's how the conversation went. And the question of whether the conversation went between Rabbi Chiya Abba and the mother, Rabbi Chiya Abba and the daughter. And that's another question of whether the mother comes with the Yivama to the Beit Din. In these situations, is she allowed to speak on her behalf? I mean, is the mother a party to this process or is the mother not? And that would depend on what girsa you have here about Ema, meaning Ema or Ema. Is it Ema that mother spoke up or Ema that she said or she would say? So that's a question, and the Girsa Rashi brings down both versions of the Gemara. And now we have another case with Rapapa. Bat Chamua de Rapapa, the daughter of the in-laws of Rapapa, which basically makes her his sister-in-law. So in the case of sister-in-law Rapapa, Nafla Lifle Yavam Sheinu Aguna. She fell into a situation with a Yavam that was not appropriate for her. It wasn't good for them to go through with the marriage. Ata de Kamei de Abaye. Amalei Chalutzta B'kacha Takonza. So Abaye uses this methodology. He says, look, go ahead. Do chalitza with her, and that's how you marry her. Amalei Rav Papa, lo sovela ma'ar lahadam Rabbi Yochanan. So Rav Papa says, wait a minute, you're using Reish Lakish's suggestion. Don't you hold like Rabbi Yochanan, who said you need kavanah from both sides? This doesn't work. So Abaye says back to Rav Papa, v'lech emalei. Abaye says to Rav Papa, if you're not going to use Reish Lakish's suggestion, then how are you going to get through this? So Amalei, so Rav Papa says to Abaye, say this, chalutz la'amanat shiten lecha matayim zuz. Say to him that you'll pay him 200 zuz, the woman will pay 200 zuz, and do the chalitza. So that's what they do. The bottle of the chalitza. So after the chalitza, amarla. So Abaye says to the woman, to Rapapa's sister-in-law, Zilhavle, pay up. You promised to pay, now pay up the money. So amarle, Rapapa comes to her defense, like Rapapa's acting as her lawyer over here, and says, no, mishatea ani becha abdalei. She did that as a joke. She really didn't mean to pay it. She wasn't intending to pay this ever. She's not going to pay it up. Milo Tanya, and he brings a proof to this. Don't we have a braita? Arei shaya boreach min beta surim. He's running away from prison. Well, assume here it's unlawful imprisonment that he was running away from. And there was a crossing, a river crossing in front of him that he needs to make. whether that's a bridge or that's a raft of some sort of ferry that takes him across. Bamalei tul dinar says to the ferry driver who doesn't really want to go without other people, he doesn't really want to make the crossing, he says to him, take a dinar, which is way overpaying for this ride. Most people pay one zulas. Here he's paying him a dinar for this. It's a huge amount of money to pay him. Fevireni, and take me across. Einu elus charo. When he gets to the other side, he only has to pay him what would be the normal fee for crossing the river. He doesn't have to pay him this money, all this crazy money that he promised him. Alma. So here, in that case of Beit HaSurim, Amarle Mishatei Anibacha. He basically says, I was joking when I said that much money. I just needed you to get across. So Achanami Mishatei Anibacha. So to in our case, you can say, I was joking. I didn't mean it. So Amarle. So now Abaye says to Rav Papa, Avuchecha. Where's your father? Amarle Bemato in the city. Emachecha. Where's your mother? Amalei b'mato, also in the city. Yav behu einei ushchivan. Abaye took one look at them, or he thought about them, gave him an ayin hara, and they passed away. Abaye, you have to know from his background, was an orphan. He grew up in the house of Rabba, and he grew up in abject poverty. He had nothing. And as Rashi explains over here, so he saw that Rav Papa was very sharp. He had all these great suggestions, all these things. He was able to pull things left and right. And he assumed the reason that he was so sharp and he was so good was because his parents lived nearby and they were supporting him. They were feeding him, taking care of all his needs, and therefore he didn't have to work for his needs. And that's why he had so much time to focus on Torah, and that's why he was so sharp. So Abaye was a little bit bitter about the way that Rav Papa acted, and therefore he gave an ayin hara, in a sense, to the parents, and the parents passed away because he thought that that's what was bringing the sharpness of Rav Papa, where he was basically running circles around Abaye. And Abaye felt bad about that, but he thought because he was so well taken care of, that's what was doing it. So Abaye basically put him into his predicament, which is that he made him an orphan by having his parents pass away. It's also, the Gemara tells us that Rav Papa was a balbasar. He's a heavy set person. It's a contrast to Abaye. Abaye grew up in abject poverty, and here's Rav Papa, who's this large individual who's eating well and fed well, and things are coming easy to him. So Abaye is upset by that incongruence or inconsistency between their lives, and therefore he basically puts Rav Papa into the same position as him, which is that his parents pass away. So now, the question about this Gemara in general, Tosafot already raises the issue, is why does this work? Why are you allowed to lie about these things and then not pay up? First, we have to deal with the fundamental question of why is this work? And then number two is, does it matter how it's phrased or how it is approached? That Tosafot discusses. So, first of all, many explain that the reason that it works over here is because the individual is really obligated to help him out. There's a din of hatzalat nefashot over here to save this individual, and they're really obligated to do it. And the same thing with chalitza. If the woman doesn't want to perform yibum, the guy has to perform chalitza. There's a certain amount of obligation on these individuals to perform the mitzvah. So they're not doing the mitzvah, so they need a little incentive, they need a little carrot to do the right thing. So we put the money in front of them to make them do the right thing. But that's not because they're going to really pay the money. The money is just to get them to do the right thing. It's a sort of kfiyah, sort of like the thing Beit Din is giving them a corporal punishment so that they end up doing the right thing. So too over here, the money is a incentive to get them to do the right thing. So in the end, you don't pay the money because they did the right thing. They did what was obligated of them. Others suggest that it's not a mitzvah at Salat Neshavot. It's just a mitzvah in general to help this individual out. And therefore, you can force them to do what they're supposed to do because they're supposed to do a mitzvah. They're supposed to do the right thing in these situations. They're not doing the right thing. So the money helps encourage them to do the right thing. Again, maybe not a mitzvah in the sense of a tzalat nefashot, but some sort of mitzvah that's here. And still other Rishonim here say that it was done under duress, and therefore it doesn't take effect because the person did it only because of that duress, not because they really wanted to enter into such an agreement.
Tosafot points out that it has to do with the amount of money that's being paid. If the quantity of money that's being promised is exorbitant relative to the activity that's undertaken, then it's clear that the money is only being paid to encourage the individual to do it. So over here, where he pays an exorbitant amount of money to have him cross the ferry, it's clear that that's not the value of the payment or the trip that this guy is undertaking. He's not doing that much work that he is deserving of that money. So that's what Tosfot says, that it's implied in the exorbitant fee is the fact that you're not going to pay it because it's crazy. How could you gouge the people for that type of money to get it across? So then you only know him only own the core money and not the exorbitant fee. Tosfot says then, but in a case where that is the fee that is normally charged, so for instance, you have a very professional expert doctor that charges an exorbitant fee, and that's his fee to everybody. So in that case, a person is in life's danger, and they need the doctor to perform. If they promise him the money, Do you have to pay the money? The answer is yes, according to Tosfot, because that's the normal fee that he commands. Since that's the normal fee that he commands, that's not something that you promised him that he doesn't normally get. You promised him his normal salary, so you got to pay him that normal salary. Other Rishonim, like the Ramban and others, disagree with that and say no. Anytime a person is charging above the services rendered, in that case, anytime you're gouging, then you can force the person to do it and not pay the fee that they're demanding, but really what the cost of their services are. Again, some of this is very hard because it comes up, I mean, the question will come really with doctor fees, which is how do you determine what the real doctor fee is? I mean, in terms of real services done, his outlays are very small and his services rendered, I mean, he couldn't charge very much for it. The reason that he's able to charge this is because of his previous experience, because of his investment of time in the past. So how can you argue? It's hard to argue what the real value of the services is. Look, the value of the services is that people are willing to pay that amount. So the market sets the price at which he's able to command, and therefore that is the real price for services. Or do we say no? The fee far exceeds the service provided. He got lucky. He gets lucky that people pay it. But that's not the real value, and therefore, even if you promise him it, if the person can't afford it, but it saves his life, then maybe he can promise it and not pay in the end. So that would be a difference here, machloket in the Rishonim, as to when do we determine that the promise of large sums of money is considered binding, an obligation to pay it, or is it just an incentive for the person to do the right thing, and then you only pay him for the real services undertaken? Tanabanan, chalitza mutet kshera. If you do this type of trickery in chalitza, works, no problem. Get muta, pasul. You do that with the get, does not work. So you have to explain why. Why by chalitza does it work, and by get does not work? We'll explain that in a second. Chalitza mi'usit, psula. A chalitza that's done by force does not work. Get mi'usa, a get that is done by force, kasher, works. Mar says, hey, chidami, what's going on here? In the case where you have force, why is it working or not working, depending on chalitza and get? So Mar says, idama rotze ani. If you say that the guy says in the end, you force him to the point where he says, yeah, I'll do it, then afilu chalitza nami. Then why doesn't chalitza work in that type of kfiya, type of force? If he never gets to the point where he says, I want to do it, I really want to give that get, then get namilo. Then the get also doesn't work. So, hachi kamar. This is what how to read this braita, which is, chalitza mutet leolam kasher. Chalitza, using that trickery, always works. It's always kasher. Get mutea leolam pasul. When it comes to a get done through that trickery, it does not work ever. Chalitza mi'usit v'get mi'usa. When you have chalitza that's done the manner of force, this kfiya of beitin, or a get mi'usa, and the same thing with a get, zimnin kasher, zimnin pasul. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Hada marotzeani, hada lo marotzeani. You want to know when it works? It works when he comes to the point where he says, I want to do it. In the case where he says, I still don't want to do it, then you can't, the force doesn't help, and the get is a problematic get in that case. The Daniel, because they have a brayta, your krivoto. Krivoto seems to imply that we force him to bring the korban. That you force him to bring a korban that he's obligated to bring. Yochol bal korchol, you would think you do it against his will. Tamalomer lirtzono, he has to bring it willingly. How do you get him to do it willingly if you're forcing him? Hakeitzad? Kofinoto ad shumer rotzani. You hit him until he says, I want to do it. So then we got him to the right place. Chenata motze b'gitei nashim. And that's the same thing you find by gitin. We use the same methodology, which is kofinoto ad shumer rotzani. You force him to the point where he says, rotzani. So now, this, the famous Rambam that is associated with this, how can you force someone to say rotzani? Any person under duress is going to say, I want to do it, because they want to get out of the problem of the duress. So the Rambam says, a famous formulation of this, he says, everybody deep down wants to do the right thing. Their neshama, their nefesh, is connected to God, and they want to do the right thing in the situation. But many times, their yetzer hara, or their intellect, or their emotions get the better of them, and they don't do the right thing because there are other forces that are pulling against them. And so by taking him to Beit Din and giving them malkot, that brings the person back to their core essence. And bringing them back to the core essence is then they finally say, Rotzani, I want to do what Hashem really wants from me. And the Rotzani is really a true Rotzani, because otherwise how do you explain the fact that you hit him and he said Rotzani? What type of Rotzani is that? So that's how the Rambam explains it. The Rambam explains that the person's getting back to their core essence, back to what they really want to do. And so therefore hitting them brings them to their truth, what they really need to do. In this case, so we're helping them get to the right conclusion, and they really want this because this is the right conclusion. That's the way that Rambam formulates it. Of course, we get Musa, we've dealt with the topic in other places, but it's not so simple. All the Rishonim talk about how does get Musa work, meaning that what's considered to be force that's allowed to be used? Number one, Do you need a Beit Din in order to do this? Number two is, even when you use force, there has to be a way that he has a way out of this, meaning that he has an option still, that he can't be forced to the point where he has no option, because instead of using corporal punishment, many times they used penalties of not allowing him to live in certain cities, blocking him from kvod. So there are things that you're allowed to do, which include in Israel today, is what they do is you take away privileges from individuals in order to force them to get a get, which is allowed, because that's not called force. That's only taking away privileges. You can remove their ability to drive, take away their driver's license, remove their ability to leave the country, take away their passport. You can remove their freedom even. You can put them, imprison them in that way, because all you're doing is taking away privileges that are granted. You're not entitled to that privilege. You're not forcing them to do anything. They still have the free choice to live without those privileges or give the get. So they have to make a decision. Is it worth not giving the get or giving up the privileges? Many times these people are so stubborn where they irrationally are willing to give up everything and sit in prison just not to give a get, which doesn't make so much sense, but that is the way that it's handled today in order not to run into problems of get museh. In other countries, some like America, there are other methodologies that are being used by some of the batidim that have a certain amount of aspersions cast upon them because whether the force that they're using is really allowed, I mean, din. That's the question. The machloket really is about how much force is allowed or how much is the option to get out of this situation. Does the person really still have free choice? How far can you go and say they still have free choice? And that's really the machloket about how much force you can apply to these individuals while they still will go ahead and make a decision, the right decision, voluntarily. And that's the real question about get me'useh. Now, as far as why this works by chalitza and does not work by gitin, how come you can trick them and say, I'll promise you $1 million by chalitza and it goes through? Promise a person by chalitza by get, it doesn't go through. What's the difference here? So Rashi says the difference has to do with the nature of a t'nai. All t'naim, or the paradigm for a t'nai, is based on t'nai b'nei Gad u'b'nei Ruvain. That the Gemara says in many places. And there, that t'nai has a certain number of conditions associated with it. One of them that is most people know is what's called the t'nai kaful, which is that the t'nai is said both in the positive and the negative form. If you do this, such and such will come about. If you don't do this, then it won't be. So that's part of it, t'nai kaful. The other thing is that the t'nai is the t'nai maseh, that the conditions are brought first, and then the activity, the outcome is afterwards. So you first have the t'nai, and then you have what will happen, the action that will take place. One of the other things that's noted there is it's something that can be done ayidei shliach. Because Moshe Rabbeinu conveys this to Yoshua ben Nun. He imparts this information to Yoshua ben Nun and says to Yoshua ben Nun, you have to carry out this for Bnei Gad Meruvin. Moshe is not going into Eretz Yisrael. So he makes Yoshua's shliach to carry this out. So one of the conditions of a t'nai is that it can be done through a shliach. And so that's, Rashi says over here, that's the key difference between get and chalitza. Get can be done ayidei shliach. A get can be sent to a woman through a shliach, or a woman can accept a get through a shliach. Therefore, you can have a t'nai embedded in a get. A t'nai will be effective by a get because you can have shlichut. Chalitza cannot be done ayidei shliach. It has to be done by the parties themselves. Since it can't be done ayidei shliach, t'nai doesn't work in chalitza. That's the way Rashi explains the difference between them. Other Rishonim explain the difference simply about, it's a question of a ma'aseh. Generally, things that are activities, actions, require the parties themselves to be involved. Whereas things that are documentary, in sense like get, don't require the parties to be involved. And therefore, you can have a shliach by the case of get. You cannot have a shliach by the case of chalitza. And therefore, you have this difference about the t'nai. So therefore, the t'nai will be effective by the get, because you can do it ayidei shliach. Over here, by chalitza, the t'nai is not effective because t'nai just doesn't work at all. There are others that suggest that there's a difference between get and chalitza, which is chalitza involves a ma'aseh, involves an action. A t'nai cannot undermine an action. A t'nai is a condition which is a agreement between parties. It's a social contract between parties that we come to an agreement that this is the case. But if you go ahead and do an action then, that action overrides the t'nai because the action is powerful in its statement of the what is being done versus the t'nai. So then what about by get? You could argue the same thing. By get, they give the get. Isn't that an override of the t'nai? No. Anytime you deal with a document like a get, that is what we call, again, it's a social contract between parties. It's a hescheim. It's an agreement. The get is a agreement between the parties. There's no action taken by gitin. Gitin, there's no action between the man and the woman except, hey, the giving of the get. But the get, that is the giving equivalent of giving a contract. It's just a contractual obligation. Or here, it's a contractual dismissal of the obligations between them. But it's a scheme. It's an agreement between them. So in things that are simply agreements, then you can have a t'nai embedded to them. So Kiddushin and Gitin, both are things that are agreements between parties. The Kiddushin, yeah, it involves an action of Ariyat Mekudesh Ali, you give the money, but it's truly, in the end, it's just an agreement between parties to come together. That agreement can have a tznai, have a condition embedded in it. Same thing with Gitin, you can have a tznai embedded in it. Chalitza, which is purely, is a real action or activity, which is pulling off the shoe, she's spitting, she's doing all these things that are involved. Over there, you can't have it. It's not about a hesken between them. It's a physical activity that's taking place, and that's what's driving the chalitza, and that's why you can't have an embedded condition in the chalitza. So that's why the din is different by chalitza than it is by gitin, for these reasons that the Rishonim are explaining that chalitza functions differently than gitin and the kiddushin. All right, now, the Gemara continues here and says, Anu alocha, Amar Rova, Amar Rav Schora, Amar Rav Huna, Chotzin, Afu Pishen Makirin. You're allowed to do chalitza, even though the Beitin can perform chalitza, even though they don't know the parties here. So we don't know if it's the Yavam or the Yavama, but they can carry out a chalitza. Now, why would you carry out a chalitza if you don't know the parties here? Because sometimes the amount of time it takes to get the evidence of who the parties are, the persons are going on an overseas trip. Say the guy's about to leave an overseas trip. They need to get the chalitza done before he leaves. So they do the chalitza, and then they'll investigate the issue afterwards. So they do the chalitza, even though they don't know who the parties are. Just assuming that we get to, afterwards, we'll figure out what's happened here, but at least we get the chalitza in before this guy takes off. So, mema'anin, afu pishein makirim. The same thing with mi'un. Where Ktana wants to reject her husband, in the same way, they can do it even though we don't recognize the parties. Lafikach, the derivative of this is, ein kotvim get chalitza, elim kein makirin. You cannot write a document of evidence that chalitza took place unless we know who the parties are. Ein kotvim get miyun, elim kein makirin. Why? The chashin on the beit din toin. Because we worry about a beit din that makes a mistake. Because if we write the document, and in the document we said this beit din performed chalitza, but we don't know the parties, so they don't write in there that they know the parties, the next Beit Din might rely on this get chalitza or this get miyun and say, okay, that looks like everything was done fine here. We'll let them go on. This woman could go married. Meantime, the first Beit Din never checked it out. And so now the second Beit Din, in order to allow this to go through, allow her to marry anyone, should have to check it out. And they'll make a mistake. So since we're worried about that type of mistake, we don't allow you to document such a action by Beit Din. That they, even though they didn't know the parties, they allowed the chalitza and the miyun to go through. We don't document it until we know for sure what happened here. And once they've documented, then we don't worry about a mistake, because then we know that the chalitza or the miyun was good. That's the way that it's formulated. Amarav, Amarav, Schor, Amarav, Huna. But then Rava Didei Omer, Rava himself, that's from his Rebbe. Now Rava himself says, Ein chotzim elim kein makirin. No chalitza is done by a Beit Din unless they know the parties. Veim emanim elim kein makirin. You can't have miyun performed unless they know the parties. Bafika. For that reason, kotvim get chalitza fu pishein makirin. The edim can write a get, evidencing the fact that there was chalitza performed, even though they don't know the parties. Because they can assume that the beit din would only do it if they knew the parties. So even though they, the edim, don't know the parties, they can write down, we saw this chalitza take place in beit din, even though we have no idea who the parties are. Bekotvim get miyun afu pishein makirin, because again, they're relying on beit din. V'lo chashin in the beit din toin. And over here, we don't worry about a beit din making a mistake. We don't worry about the first beit din doing it when they don't know the parties. The Edim can testify that they saw chalitza and they don't have to worry about it. Ah, what about the fact that the first Beit Din might not have known the parties? No, we don't worry about that. Beit Din will carry it out properly and make sure that they know the parties before they carry out the chalitza or the miyun. All right, this is the Girsa of Rashi, and this is the way that Rashi explains the Gemara. Rashi says that the first opinion is that Beit Din's allowed to do it without knowing the parties, but the Edim, or nobody can testify the fact that it happened because of the fear that the second Beit Din will make a mistake. Rava disagrees and says that Beit Din can only do it if they know the parties, and therefore you can write it or you can document it even though you don't know the parties, because we don't worry about the first Beit Din making a mistake. Forget about the second Beit Din, they're going to be fine for sure, but we don't worry about the first Beit Din. Tosafot criticizes Rashi's approach here for a number of reasons, one of which is that the word Beit Din Toin here means different things in both cases. In the first case, Beit Din Toin, we're worrying about the second Beit Din making a mistake. In the second case, we worry about the first Beit Din making a mistake. It means that the word Beit Din Toin here is inconsistent between the two statements of Rava and his Rava in the name of Rav Schora. And so that's one of the reasons that Tosafot rejects it. Number two is that Rava holds that Makashin Beit Din Toin. Rava does worry about a Beit Din making a mistake. So the Gemara in Bava Batra seems to indicate that the Girsa here is just the opposite. So the real question is, which Girsa governs? Rashi has the Girsa that's in front of us in the Gemara, and he upholds the Girsa that's of the Gemara. Tosafot, based on the Gemara in Bava Batra, flips the Girsa over here. He flips it because he has the Gemara in Bava Batra, and then he also says, we have these Sfarim Yishanim, we have these older Sfarim that actually have the Girsa like that of the Gemara in Bava Batra. And therefore they switch it around and say that the first case is, Ein Choshishin the Beit Din Toin, that we don't worry about a Beit Din Toin. So in the case here where, in the first instance, we're Rav Schora, which is that we allow Beit Din to go ahead and perform Chalitza and Miyun, even though they don't know the parties. We don't let anybody document it, but we allow them to do that. And we don't worry about the fact, Lo Chayshin on the Beit Din Toin, we don't worry about the fact that a second Beit Din will come and be matir this woman based on what the first Beit Din actions were. We know that the second Beit Din will know that they could have done it without knowing the parties, and therefore they have to check in to the parties over here. We don't worry about that second Beit Din making that mistake. Therefore, the first Beit Din can perform Chalitza or Miyun, even though they don't know the parties. Again, why would you do that? Because one of the parties is leaving. That we want to take care of the issue. But then, the other Beit Din will take care of the problem of finding out or figuring out who it is. Then, Rova's statement is, Ein Chotzin, Imekein Makirin. We only allow you to do Chalitza and Miyun, and when you know them, why? Chashin on the Beit Din Toin. We worry about a Beit Din that makes a mistake. First case is that we're worried about the second Beit Din relying on the first Beit Din. Because the first Beit Din did without knowing. And there, Rava says the name of Schor, we don't worry about that. Let them do the Chalitza even without knowing them, and the second Beit Din will deal with what they have to deal with. Rava says, no, we're worried about that second Beit Din. If the first Beit Din does it without knowing them, the second Beit Din might be matir them, and allow it to go through on the basis of the first Beit Din, even though they didn't check it out. And so therefore, Chashina on the Beit Din Toin. We worry about a Beit Din Toin, and therefore Rava says, the first Beit Din must know them before it allows the Chalitza to go through. So they flip the girsan here, but then it becomes more consistent with the Gemara of Abba Batra, and it solves the problem by doing that. It also makes the word Beit Din Toin consistent here. Because now in both cases, it's the second Beit Din that's the Beit Din Toin, not the first Beit Din. So that's the alternate girsa in this Gemara. Now, the Rishonim ask here, you can see it in the Tosfot Yishanim himself, he says that in Gitin and Kiddushin, we don't have to know the parties. There are many times that we allow a get to go through when we don't know the parties. Many times we allow Kiddushin to go through when we don't know the parties. How come that works? How come over there we say everything's fine and dandy, and all of a sudden over here by Chalitza, you have to know the parties? What's the difference about Chalitza then versus Kiddushin and Gitin? So the Tosfot Yishanim asks us here, B'shema, Hacha Mayri Shigama Yavam Inu Makir Ba, She Yivimto. Here, the case here is different than those cases, because in those other cases, at least one party knows who it is. So for instance, a guy says, I accepted Kiddushin on behalf of my daughter, I just don't know who gave the Kiddushin. I don't know who the party was. And a guy shows up and says, I was the one. In that case, we believe him. And we allow it to go through, even though there's no Hekera, even though we don't know for certain. Why? Because one party says for certain they know who the situation is. So here he says, Shema Achamari Shigama Yavaminu Makirat Shihi Yivimto. That here, the Yavam himself doesn't know this is Yivimto. He lives overseas. And they don't know whether they're parties to each other. And therefore now, it's not only that Beit Din doesn't know them, they don't know each other. They don't even know if they're performing Yivum or Chalitza with the right party over here because they don't know who this party is. They don't know who the brother is at all. Same thing by Miyun. So the Tosfot Yishanim basically says the difference is in this situation between the cases. In the situation of Kitin and Kiddushin, at least one of the parties recognize each other. They know that they both admit something happened over here. And then we have one party that says this is what happened. In the case of Chalitza over here, we have two parties who may not know each other, have no idea who the other party is. And therefore, that's why we say they have to be makirin. That's why we have a higher standard of evidence over here. That's one possibility of how to answer it. Other Rishonim answer that in the case of the Kiddushin and Gitin, there's no reason for the parties to lie over there. There's no reason for the parties to say something that isn't true because they're not going to end up in a situation in which it's beneficial to them. Therefore, we don't have to be makirin because they're doing it and it makes sense that they would do it in this case because there's no benefit. On the other hand, by the case of Yibum over here, there is a large benefit for this woman to be released from this itch. She's taking advantage of the situation and based on getting herself released, even though maybe she shouldn't be released. She's getting herself out of a situation that may not be true. And there she has incentive to do this because she may not want to go through with the Yibum. And therefore we worry about it, and that's why we have to be Makirin. That's what other Rishonim say. But that is a basic question here. How come by Gitin and Kiddushin we don't have this level or threshold of evidence? And yet over here by Chalitza, we do have this threshold of evidence. Again, the Tosfot Yishanim, others take up the issue. Alright, next Mishnah. Mitzvot Chalitza. Here is the process of Chalitza. How is Chalitza done? Bahu v'yimto the Beit Din. He and his Yivamah come to Beit Din. V'hein mesiyan lo etza ugenet lo. So we learned this before. They give him good advice. Good advice means, is this a good marriage? If she's old and he's younger, or he's older and she's younger, al tavi ketata le beitecha. Don't bring quarrel into your house. Meaning that this is not a good marriage, and just because it's a mitzvah Yibum, sometimes it's a mitzvah Chalitza, because that's the better outcome. So they advise him whether he should go through with this in Yibum or perform Chalitza. Shneamar v'karulo ziknei ro v'dibru elav. Because they call him and they speak to him. What do you mean they speak to him? They listen, this may be good for you, this may not be good for you. Then,
Once they decide they're going to perform chalitza, v'hi omeret. She then states, so this is her time that she has to speak up, me'ein yivami la'akim la'achiv shem b'Yisrael, lo ava yavmi. So she says he refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. Lo ava yavmim. He doesn't want to perform yibum over here. Then v'hu omer. Then he says, so here's the part where he speaks up and says, lo chafatzi l'kachta. I have no interest in taking her. I do not want to perform yibum with her. U'b'shon ha'kodesh ha'yu omrim. They both have to say this in Hebrew because this is one of two reasons. The Gemara in Sota quotes it because it says vana or vanta. And those are words, are key words through Gzeirah Shava that teach you that it has to be said l'shon ha'kodesh from other instances in Torah. But generally, the difference is between what we call ceremonial items versus items where you are communicating. In items where you're communicating, then the language that you say it in has to be in language you understand. In what we call tiksi, religious ceremonial procedures, over there we need you just to say it in Hebrew because that is what it is. It's exactly that. It's a religious ceremony and therefore we want it done in Hebrew, not necessarily understood. So if you explain to them they're performing Yibum, and then they just have to repeat the thing in Lashon HaKodesh. They know what they're doing. They don't need to know the exact words. But since it's a religious ceremony, it has to be done in Hebrew. So now, v'nik shayvim tovei lav, then after this has gone down, le'nei hazkenim, she comes in front of the zkenim, in front of the beit din, v'chaltza na'alo mi'araglo, she takes the shoe off of his leg or his foot, v'yarka b'fanav, and then she spits in front of him, ro kanira l'dayanim, has to be spit that is seen or visible to the dayanim, v'anta v'yamra, and then she again speaks up, so this is what we said in Friday's daf, that she speaks twice. She speaks once before and once afterwards. She speaks before she does the action of chalitza and rikika, and then she speaks again afterwards. So she put in the beginning that he refuses to do anything. Then afterwards she says, after she's done this action, v'amra, she says, kachay yaseh le'ish asher yivneh et beit achiv. This is what you do to a person who refuses to build up the house of his brother. Ad kan hayu makrin. Until there, they read to them or led them word by word. If they didn't know Lashon HaKodesh, they read in front of them and they prompted them to say these words. When Rabbi Hurkanus did this under the tree, under the alone, under the oak, in Kfar Eitam, he finished off to the end of the parsha, which means that he says, so he read all the way through, and he had the woman say it all the way through, even though it wasn't necessary, because that's not part of her statement. Nevertheless, they read it through to the end. Once he started doing that, the minhag took hold, and therefore, the woman read the end of the parsha. V'nikra b'shmo b'Yisrael beit chalutzanal. So now, they read the rest of the parsha, which is, v'nikra b'shmo b'Yisrael beit chalutzanal. Mitzvah b'danayanim. That, to call him chalutzanal, that's a mitzvah on the danayanim to say that, v'lo mitzvah talmidim, but not those that are seated around. It's only on the beit din to say chalutzanal, not all those that are present. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, mitzvah kol omdim sham namar chalutzanal. That the mitzvah is on everybody who's present to say chalutzanal. Why? Because it says here, v'nikra shmo b'Yisrael, that his name will be in Israel. Now, if you just talk about dayanim, that's not all of Israel. If you talk about everybody that's there, then all of a sudden it becomes like there's a kahal here, there's a group here, and everybody's calling him that. That's his ilo nikra shmo b'Yisrael, and therefore you have to say chalutza now. Everybody present will say chalutza now. Also, it's interesting here, Rabbi Hurkanus does not appear in the Mishnah very often. He's obviously a Tana because he's appearing in the Mishnah. We don't have any evidence of who he is. The only speculation you can have is that he's related to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, which means either he's the father of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus or he's the son of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, because in their day they named after a living father. It was every other generation had the name of the father. So he could be Rabbi Hurkanus ben Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, although in the fact that it says Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus and doesn't call him Rabbi Hurkanus would indicate that it's not his father, more likely that it is his son. But that also explained why it took a hold, because he's a very early Tana. That means that he's one of the very early Tanaim, and he had a connection to the door in front of him, and that's why his minog took hold and had a lot of tokif, had a lot of power here, because he's considered to be a very early Tana that had good mesora from the earlier generations, and that's why when he practiced this, that it took hold and everybody did it afterwards. Right, I'm reading the mitzvot, chalitza, korah, v'koreh, chuletzet, v'rokaka, v'korah, which is what was described in our Mishnah here, which is, she reads, he reads, or she speaks up, he speaks up, then she removes the shoe, spits, and then she reads again. Somebody says, my kamash v'lan matznitani, it's straight out written in our Mishnah, why are you telling us, what does this shorthand tell us? The hakamash v'lan mitzvah hachi, bi'apich leit lamba. Rabbi Yehuda says mitzvah. The word mitzvah is a code word instead of using the word chovah. If you said chovah, it would mean an obligation, that would mean the seder is ma'akev.
the order is ma'akev. The fact that he says a mitzvah over here means that it's not ma'akev the order, and therefore if you change it around, b'diavad, it works. So the order is the proper way to do it, but it's not the only way to do it. I mean, if you do it the wrong way, it still works out. Tanya Nami Yochi, have a braita that says that, ben shiktim chalitza l'rikika, ben shiktim rikika l'chalitza. What she does, they remove the shoe before the spitting, or the spitting before the remove the shoe, mashasa asui, whatever's done is done. It's not so clear from this braita that it's all the proof in the world. There it just talks about the activities or the actions that you flip them around. It doesn't talk about the kriya, which is not clear that that also has to be. Seemingly, the kriya would have to be before because it's describing what they're about to do or why they're going through the procedure. It would seem that the kriya should be beforehand. All right. So now, Amar Abaye, Haiman de Makre get chalitza. One of the dayanim who's reading out for the parties, meaning that they're prompting them to read instead of a teleprompter. In their day, they had someone reading it out because not everybody was literate. And besides that, not everybody knew Hebrew. So the dayanim are getting them to try to say out what they're supposed to say in Hebrew. So they read in front of them. They prompt them to do it. So that person who does it, who reads again, chalitza, lo likre ledida, lo luchudei, va'avayib mi luchudei. Don't parse the sentence this way. The end of the pasuk that she's reading is lo avayib mi. He does not want to perform yibum. Don't split it up in half and say lo, and then she says lo, and then avayib mi as a second statement. Don't do that. Damashma, because then it sounds like avayab me. That it sounds like he wants to perform yibum over here. Ella, you have to say it all together. Lo avayab me. You have to say it all together. The way that they're saying it's being parsed is because the pasuk who says this. The pasuk begins, Me'en yifami lakim lakim shem bi Yisrael. That'll be the first part. Then it says, lo. He doesn't want to do that. So it's a double negative, which is, he doesn't not want to be yikim shem achiv. He really wants to perform Yibum over here. So it'll be misunderstood by parsing it in that way. The lo would reference the first part of the pasuk. And avayami would be then, oh yeah, he wants to go through with Yibum. So don't parse it that way. Rather put it all together and say lo ya avayami in one shot. So you have to do it in that manner. And then the same thing is true by him. The person that is reading out to the man, don't say lo kriyeli didei, lo luchudei, and chafatzi lakachta luchudei. Don't say lo by itself, and then chafatzi lakachta by itself, because the mashma chafatzi lakachta. He will say, no, I don't agree what she's saying. Chafatzi lakachta, I really want to take her. So Ella, he has to say lo chafatzi lakachta in one shot, so that it's clear that the lo is referencing the statement that he's making over here. Rava Amar, Rava says, doesn't make a difference. If suke miltahi, it's simply taking a breath in between words. Suke milta leidlamba, when you parse in that way, it doesn't change the meaning. It's simply a little pause in what you're saying. You're not punctuating the sentence, and therefore, it's fine. We don't worry about that at all. Tosfot points out that in Gemara and Sukkah, Rava said just the opposite. He says that it makes a difference how you say something, and then Rav Safra says to him, no, it doesn't. It's just taking a breath. So Tosfot says, maybe Rava accepted. After Rav Safra criticized him about this, then Rava took up that position, and this is really the position of Rav Safra that he is now taken on. Rav Ashi Ashkechei the Rav Kahana. So Rav Ashi found Rav Kahana, come it's Tairu Makri Law. He was having a lot of trouble getting this woman to say Lo Avayami in one shot. He was trying to get her to say all three words in one shot in Hebrew. It was difficult for her, and he was going through a lot of pain to get this to work out. Samalei Lo Savalei Mar Lahad the Rava. Says, don't you hold a Rava that just doesn't make a difference? Do it word by word. What does it matter? They have to put it all together. Amalei Mo the Rava Lo Avayami. Rava agrees in the case of Lo Avayami that you should say it in one shot. Now here's Machloket in the Rishonim as to what that means. Did Rava in the end agree to everything? And he says, Lo Avayami as well as Lo Chafatzi Lakachta. Is that the case? Or is it only in the case of Lo Avayami that he worries about it? Because there you have the wording in the Pasuk beforehand. So by Lo Chafatzi Lakachta, there's Lo doesn't reference anything except what he's saying. Lo Chafatzi Lakachta, period. There's nothing before that the Lo can reference. I mean, you could argue that the statement of the woman is what it's referencing, but in the case of the woman, you have a statement beforehand, which is, Me'en yivami lakim l'achiv shem b'Yisrael. There, she makes a statement. Then the lo could be referencing that statement or the second half. And therefore, the parsing makes a difference. So that's why only in that case do we worry about it, not in the case of the man. So that's Machloket Rishonim as to whether uniquely in this case we worry about it or in all cases that we worry about it. So he says, but Rava does worry about it. Therefore, I am trying to get her to say the right thing. Amar Abaye, Hayman dichtav gita dechalitzta. Person who writes a document evidencing a chalitza, lichtov hachi. He should say this. Akrinu ledida. We read out her, we prompted her to say, mi mein yivami ad avayabmi. Yet, you write dot, 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 basically in there. You say, we read to her, mein yivami, my yivam refused, dot, 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 ad avayabmi. Until that. We don't read out the whole pasuk that she said, but we put in the highlights, the beginning and the end of the statement that we had her say. Vakrinu lididei min lo adlakachta.
Again, we read to him from lo. We don't write lo chavazi. It'd probably been easier just to write lo chavazi lakachta, but we don't write lo chavazi. We say lo until the kachta for him.
Vakrinu lidida, and then again, vakrinu lidida. Again, we prompted her min kacha yaseleish. Right from that part of the puzzle ad chalutzana until the end. The way that the bias suggests is that when they write it in there, they don't write out the whole pasuk that they read to her. They just say, we read from this point to this point, from beginning to end. Give you the first word and the last word of the areas that we read.
Marzutra misartet uktiv lekula parshata.
He used to draw lines on there. He used to demarcate where to write and then read the whole parsha.
So matkif la mar baride valonitani katev.
What are you talking about? You're not allowed to write in a parsha like this.
And the law is like Marzutra that you can't write it down.
So Rashi explains over this that there is a case in the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin says that you're not allowed to write a Sefer Torah unless you have Sirtut. You're not allowed to write a full Pasuk. You're not allowed to write more than 3 words of the Torah. If you write 3 words of the Torah, you don't need Sirtut. If you write more than 3 words of Torah, 4 words, you need Sirtut, which means you need lines there. That's what we have in our Sefer Torah. If you look carefully in your Sefer Torah, there are lines that are cut into the Sefer Torah to hang the letters from. That's the upper bar of the writing. It ensures that everything is straight. It ensures that it's a proper type of writing. The Gemara in Gittin says you need sirtut if you can write more than 3 words of the Torah. You need sirtut. So the assumption here is that if you're going to write the whole pasuk, then you're writing more than 3 words. You have to have sirtut over here. That's what Marzutra did. He did sirtut and he wrote the whole pasuk out. Abai, who didn't have sirtut, just said write from the what's the first word and the end word, and then you don't have to write the whole thing out. You don't need sirtut. So then we have a question from Baridi, who says, wait a minute, how can you write this down at all? The Gemara in Gittin says you're not allowed to write a sub-paragraph or a sub-parshia of the Torah. You can't write the Sefer Torah unless you write the whole Sefer. You have to write the whole Sefer. You can't just take one little parsha in the Torah, do sirtut and write out the parsha, even to teach children. Even though you're teaching children, you can't just write a small paragraph of the Torah and then give it to them, and that's like as if they have a piece of the Torah. Not allowed to do that. So what, isn't that a problem over here? Over here, you're writing a portion of the Torah inside of a document. So why is that allowed? The Gemara says, Hilchata Gemara Zutra. Doesn't explain why, but Rashi gives the explanation why there's a difference over here, and Rashi says, Aval hai sfirat dvarim hu, v'la b'kdushtetei hu. Over here, you're simply telling over an incident or recalling or recounting a story. You are not writing it down to have kedushat sefer Torah. He says it's a big difference. When you're writing it for a child to learn from, you're really intending it to have a kedushat sefer Torah, have a kedushat sefer. Therefore, if you only write a single parshia of the Torah, that's not allowed. Even if you do it sirtu, it doesn't matter. You're not allowed to do it. Over here, you're not trying to write down the Torah. You're trying to evidence of what happened. So you're telling over that they said these psukim. In that case, you need sirtu to write the pasuk. But it's allowed because you're not trying to write something that has kedushat sefer Torah or has a kedushah of Torah. So therefore, it's allowed. And that's the difference over here. And that's why we paskin like Marzutra, that you're allowed to write down the whole thing, even though it's not allowed in other instances. Amar Rabbi Rakaka v'kalatato aruach. So he spits, and the wind took off with the spit. Lo astav lo klum. So when she spits in front of him, if the wind caught that spittle as it came out and took it off, doesn't work, doesn't count. So my taima, why does that not work? It says v'yarka b'manav yininan. We need him to hear the spit in front of him. So therefore, he has to see the spit, meaning it has to come down either in front of him, down below. It doesn't have to be on him himself, but it has to be down, that he has to be able to see it. She spits and it takes off with the wind. It never really comes to him or in front of him. So hilkach hu aruch v'hi gotza. If he is very tall and she is very short, kalatado aruach ika b'fanav. If the wind takes off with it, then it works. It's fine. Why? Because from the moment that she spit, it was already in front of him because he's much taller than her. He's looking down. Anything she does is b'fanav, in front of him. So therefore, if the wind pulls away the spittle as it comes out of her mouth, it's totally fine because he's standing there and it's in front of him. He aruka, if she's tall, v'hu goats, and he's short, then bein ha'damata ha'diape, v'hadar azil. That if the wind takes it off, it won't work until the spittle reaches level with him. So when she spits, she's above him. So that's not bifanav. Bifanav means from his face and downward. So you have to wait until the spit gets below the level or the plane of his face. Then if the wind takes it off, it's fine. But if the wind sweeps it away before that, it would not be good. Amar Rava, achla tuma v'rakta. Achla gargishta virakta. If she eats garlic and that causes a lot of saliva in her mouth and then she spits, or she eats a clod of dirt, the gargishta, which was supposed to have some sort of medicinal properties to it, she eats that and it causes a lot of saliva and she spits, lo astav lo klum, doesn't work. Why? My Talmud, v'yarka me'atzma be'inan. V'yarka means that she creates the saliva of her own. The saliva or the spit is coming from her, not because she has some other exogenous variable creating the saliva or the spit here. V'leka, you don't have that in the case of gargishta or tuma or shum. V'amar Rav, tzrichei da'ayne, the mechzei roka, this is something we saw, we quoted earlier on Daf Kuf Aleph. Which is Rabbi says, the Dayanim have to see the spit that's coming out. When it leaves the mouth of the Yavamah, the juxtaposition of the Yenei Zekinim to Yarka tells you that the Yenei Zekinim have to see her spit. As opposed to the Yavam, who does not need to see it. And therefore, a Yavam can be a Suma and still have it. Even though it says here, it has to be in front of him. In front of him here means that it just has to be in front. It doesn't mean that he has to see it necessarily. It has to get to the physical point that it's in front of him. There's no demand that he see it physically. But over here by the Dayanim, there is a demand that it be physically seen, and therefore the Dayanim cannot be sumin. V'nikra shmo b'Yisrael beit chalutza now, mitzvah b'dayanim v'lo b'talmidim. Tanya, I'm Rabbi Yehuda, pamachat ayinu yoshvim lifnei Rabbi Tarfon, u'bata yivamah lachlotz. We're sitting in front of Rabbi Tarfon, and Yivamah came along to do chalitza, v'amar lanu, anu kuchem. He said to us, all the Talmidim sitting around, all of you answer, chalutzanal, 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 three times, which throughout Shas, whenever you say three times, that's something that's done for emphasis and pirsum. So for instance, when they used to do the Sirat Omer, when they used to cut the Omer, and they wanted to undermine the Tzukim and show that you do it not on Sunday, you do it anytime during the week, and you do the Sirat Omer, they used to do Tzor, and they used to answer, yes, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead. They used to do everything three times in order to make a big public demonstration of it, and so it's over here. Chalutzanal, 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 three times. It's mefarsim. It makes it into a big deal, into a public demonstration, and that's what we want over here, both from the perspective of, we want a public demonstration because of what we said earlier for the woman's sake, that either Kohanim know not to marry her, or that she's now on the market for Shiduchin, and also from the husband's sake because it says that in Krashmo B'Yisrael, his name has to be called amongst Israel, so saying it three times makes it into a public demonstration, so it's as if it said, Big Klal Yisrael. And with that, we end the parak. Hadron Halach, mitzvah chalitza.